Well, a bit earlier, an annual tradition took place that signals the beginning of the century tournament of champions on Maui. Prior to the first tee ball being struck, Hawaiian cultural advisor Clifford Naoli blessing the first tee at Kapalua. Speaking of the opening tee shots, struck at 9:40 local time, Garrick Higo first off, playing in a twosome alongside Joel Damon. Round one of a new year on the PGA Tour underway as we are teeing things up next on Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Arguably no better spot to be on the planet than Kapalua for the first week of January, especially if you're in that field of 38, teeing it up in the Century Tournament of Champions for the 24th time, the Plantation Course playing host to the kickoff event in calendar year on the PGA Tour. So it's officially game day for the first time in 2022 on the PGA Tour. Golf fans thinking about time. Inside our Golf Channel studios, I'm George Savarikas with Golf Channel contributor Eamon Lynch, and this is Golf Today. I know the players in the PGA Tour enjoyed that brief 45-day break. Are you showing a little excitement now that we finally have some golf to talk about inside the ropes?
Oh, sure. I'm getting my fix again, George. It has been 45 days since the last putt dropped at the RSM Classic, and they hit the ground running now. They don't stop for the next 34 weeks until someone picks up a $20 million check this year at Eastlake in August. Just a sign of how far we've come, Al Besselink won the first edition of the Tournament of Champions. He's still alive. He's almost 100 years old. He won $10,000 for that 68 years ago.
Wow. Talk about hopping the DeLorean and going back in time. What I'm looking forward to is you have players inside the top 10 like a John Rahm or Colin Morikawa where you think potentially this could be a rivalry. They could maybe separate themselves. You also have guys inside the top 10 kind of looking for their game a little bit, like a Justin Thomas. So it'll be curious to see how these guys use this week to maybe springboard them prior to the West Coast swing.
Yeah, and that's a very individual reaction that guys are going to have this week. And it doesn't actually always tell you anything. If you go back 4 years, 2018, Brooks Koepka was dead last in the field by 6 shots. He was 37 strokes behind Dustin Johnson, who won that year. But that was also the year Koepka went on and won 2 majors.
Yeah, okay, so you're saying a small sample size this week. We shouldn't go crazy with what happens at the Century Tournament of Champions. Let's take a look at the notable tee times at Kapalua. Bryson DeChambeau, Tony Finau. Wow, they're going to be blasting it at 4:55 Eastern time. Phil Mickelson, been a while since Lefty teed it up at Kapalua. He's playing in the same group as Hideki Matsuyama. And then you got world number one, John Rahm and Xander Schauffele roaming the fairways together at 5:35. Eastern time. So, as I mentioned, just absolutely gorgeous out there. This year marks Maui's 24th year hosting the Century Tournament of Champions. What an impressive field they have, punctuated with 8 of the top 10 in the world to kick off 2022. So for more from Kapalua, we welcome in John Wood. Woody, drawing a great assignment this week. First off, what should viewers be watching for later today during our first round coverage?
You know, I think it's good. Like this place is always, you just drive it as far as you can. The fairways are very generous. I think guys come here because it's a very easy place to start in terms of driving. You can hit it as far as you want, see what's going on with your swing. As far as approaches to the greens are fairly large. But, you know, it's tough to get wedges close here for some reason. I've never quite figured out why. But the most difficult thing here is the walk. It's just most guys have had some time off. Hopefully they've been in the gym. If they haven't, they're in for some hurting this week because I'm looking forward to giving my caddy brethren a little heat out there as they're walking up the hills, asking them if they're all right, because it's the toughest walk we do all year.
John, you had an interesting tweet last night in all of these changes to the rules, which includes the banning of the green reading books. It also now does not include the course map, which a lot of caddies, you said, use just to get the wind direction. And a lot of people will say that, you know, just throw some grass in the air and you'll get that information. But it's not that simple, is it? And it's not that simple at this particular course this week.
No, it's not. And in fact, I think throwing up grass is probably the least effective way of figuring out the wind, because all that tells you is what the wind's doing where you're standing, not where your ball's going to be flying. I think you really got to get an idea of direction, look up the forecast, and do it other ways. Look at flags that are in the distance. But the wind here should be fairly consistent. But yeah, I think the course map thing is just, it's a temporary. It'll come back. I think it'll be in the yardage book. The thing is, they're not approved, committee approved right now. Once they get the uniform course map, I think those will be back for the caddies and players to use.
John, you've done a good job of tweeting out aspects of the rule changes that you found to be a bit odd. How substantive a change is this for the workflow of caddies inside the ropes? For the average golf fan, I think it's hard to really understand the dynamic that will shift between player and caddy with the changes.
Yeah, it's going to be a big adjustment. Big adjustment for some, not so much for others. I'll be anxious to watch Bryson this year, because I don't think anybody based their green reading more on what the information in the book than Bryson did. Everything he did was based on the numbers, the slopes, the percentages. Whereas other guys like Jordan Spieth, I think, will show no ill effects. He's so creative. He's so imaginative that I think without the books, I don't think it'll make any difference. He may even putt better. And I think you'll see, I think the numbers, honestly, at the end of the year are going to be about the same putting stats wise. I think some guys will putt better, some guys will putt worse. But in the end, I don't think it's going to make a big difference in terms of stats. As far as on the course, yeah, it's going to be a huge adjustment, because you just got to, you have all this information, and some of it, honestly, you've had these books of your caddy for years and years. You're not sure where you got some of this information. It may be 15, 20 years old, but you're not sure if you got it with a laser or a level. And if you're not sure, you cannot put that in your book yet. So a lot more homework again on the greens, and not as much information probably.
So the green book story is one that's going to play out over the course of the year. John, what are the storylines that you're looking for over the next 4 days?
You know, hopefully it doesn't come up at all. I mean, that's my honest hope, is it doesn't come up at all. But and I don't think it will, because it's early in the year. I think where we're going to look at it is a few, maybe a couple months or a few weeks into the year, when possibly there's some question marks as to where some people got information that is written down in their books. I'm not saying it's going to be widespread or it's going to be one or two guys. And I'm not sure it's going to happen at all. But I think there will be some questions over some people if they're constantly going into their book over and over and over again on the greens as to where maybe they gained some of this information. Like I said, hopefully nothing comes of it, and it's not a story all year. But I think at some point it's going to come up.
John, which player in the field this week would you say is the biggest question mark?
Boy, that's a good question. I would say Bryson, only because of the putting. He's so fascinating. It's a great course for him in terms of driving, because fairly wide fairways. He can, he hits it farther than anybody. He can really take lashes at it this week because the fairways are soft. They're not going to run through anywhere. But the question for me is going to be watching him on the greens, and I'll be out with him today, so it'll be fascinating to see his new routine. And I don't think it's a question mark in terms of playing well or not. I think it's a question mark as what his new system is going to be on the greens.
John, I'm curious about what players you expect something from this week, and I'm particularly curious about Justin Thomas, because he's got our old pal Jim Bones Mackay on the bag, which, on most courses on tour, Jim is going to add something to it. But Jim didn't come here very often because Phil hasn't played it in 21 years, 22 years. What do you expect from that partnership this week and this year?
Yeah, sure. Very true. And I think Bones is so experienced, maybe not on this course for a while, but he knows when to lay back. He knows that Justin Thomas has a phenomenal record here, and Bones will not get overly involved when Justin's is sure about a shot. I guarantee you that. On the other hand, Bones is one of the best Bermuda greens readers I've ever seen in my life. Phil used to bring him in all the time on Bermuda greens, because that's Bones grew up on. So I could see Justin bringing him in quite a bit on the reeds. But like I said, Bones will not get overly involved on a course that he knows Justin plays so well.
John, you were saying your caddy brethren are going to be hoofing it this week. I'm hoping you have a combo of cart plus some walking for your sake.
Yeah, this course has what we call as caddies a few knee kissers, and the first one you're going to see is coming up that ninth, where your head is just down and your chin is about 2 inches from your knees for the entire walk up, and you don't even want to look up to see how much farther you have to go. You just want to feel your feet going flat again, and you get happy.
A lot of ice baths in the future for the loopers this week, John. Appreciate it. Look forward to the broadcast.
You got that right. Thanks. Me too.
All right, so this from PGA Tour Communications. Due to wet conditions, preferred lies are in effect for the first round of the Century Tournament of Champions, so something to watch for later from Kapalua. And still to come, world number two Colin Morikawa chasing more than just a win this week. He's on the verge of history. We're going to explain that when Golf Today returns.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life.
It wasn't exactly a smooth start for Victor prior to the beginning of tournament play. This was via Instagram, Hovland's clubs arriving a little late. Finally gets him, opens it up, and then can't say I'm surprised, broken club head there. Basically, the worst case scenario for Victor Hovland. So, for more on Hovland, let's say aloha to our Steve Burkowski. Burko, Hovland living every golfer's nightmare, basically. Long flight, check the clubs, disaster. How's he handling this situation?
Well, Georgie's handling it as he handles most things. Victor Hovland, a big smile on his face. He was fortunate that his caddy, Shea, had some clubs here in Hawaii. He had used them for a couple of days. The good news there, though, the driver that broke, he told me yesterday, it was his backup driver. It wasn't a gamer, so he had no issues there. And in my discussion with Victor yesterday, we talked about the journey for himself and his equipment as well, but also touched on the two wins he had to close out 2021 as he defended at Mayakoba and then went in the Bahamas just a couple weeks ago. After that win, he went home to Norway, but he's thrilled to be back here in Maui and looking to build some momentum off that strong finish just a month ago.
I had two interesting weeks there that, you know, not everything kind of went my way, but still managed to kind of get the win in the end. And I think that gives me a lot of confidence going forward that, okay, I don't have to be perfect throughout the week and still be in contention. So just kind of trust the process and get a little better every day.
How much do you assess the previous 12 months maybe in terms of what you look to achieve here moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you want to win tournaments and play good golf, but it's not that easy. And I'm very happy about my performance the last couple of years, and hopefully I can continue to trend the right direction.
What are some of the things in particular you would like to achieve here?
Yeah, I didn't play very well here last year, so you know, it's still a little bit of rust to wipe off, and just try to get my game back in kind of the place I want it to be, and you know, try to play the best I can. If I can be in contention, that'd be a lot of fun, but it's a long season.
Traveling is always a long journey. You've been in Hawaii for a few days. For those that don't know, share the journey of yourself here and your golf clubs finally arriving.
Yeah, I flew all the way from Norway here, and it's a long trip. I didn't get my clothes or my golf bag when I first got here, but I got my clothes the next day, so that was fine. But took 6 days for the golf bag to show up, and yeah, ready to rock and roll now.
How did you deal with the downtime? I know your caddy, Shea, provided some sticks to at least get some practice.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't touched a club since Bahamas, so at least Shea was able to show up with his clubs, and I was able to play the last 2 days and just kind of, you know, get into the swing of things again. But now I've got my own clubs and hopefully dial those in.
Crisis averted for Victor Hovland. Clubs in tow, he's out there. 2022 underway for the Norwegian here in Maui. And you might remember, George, when Victor defended at Mayakoba just a couple of months ago, early in the week, his gamer of a driver broke during a practice round. That's when James Hahn stepped in, who had a very similar driver, not the exact specifications, but Victor used it well, went on his way to victory. So you asked me at the beginning, how does he deal with things? I think Victor Hovland just goes with the flow. There's a reason why he's the seventh-ranked player in the world.
And Victor learned an important lesson at Mayakoba. If Danny Lee is doing speed training drills on a Wednesday on the range, don't let him use your driver for a couple cracks at it. Berko, I appreciate it. Let's take a look at the top 10 in the world. Right now, John Rahm in the top spot, followed by Colin Morikawa. Dustin Johnson, world number 3, isn't in the field at Kapalua. You see Sam Burns, what an ascension he has had the past 12 months to jump all the way up to number 10. Victor Hovland, we were just chatting about, is currently at number 7. So some of the tee times to take note of. Colin Morikawa, 5:15 Eastern time with Patrick Reed, who has a new look in a lot of ways for 2022. So Morikawa this week has a chance to get to world number 1. Here's Colin on what it would mean to reach the top spot in the men's game.
It's been a dream my entire life to get to number 1 in the world, but it's not just about getting to number 1, it's about sustaining that. And, you know, having the opportunity, obviously having an opportunity here, and it's all, you know, it's all in my control. All I can do is try and win the tournament, and that's all I'm going to focus on. But it's a huge goal. You know, it always has been, and it means something that when you do get there, you know, it means you're doing something right, or at least a good amount of things right. And it's just about continuing that process. And it's not like that's a peak, just I get to number 1 and I can go retire and relax on the beach. Like, there are still so many things that I'm going to keep pushing myself when that, if or when that does happen. So, you know, for me, it's just every week, go out and try and win, and we'll see what happens from there.
Damon, I know you asked me, what are the scenarios at play? So, very easy graphic to follow here. A win, John Rahm places lower than solo second and becomes world number 1. Finishes solo second, John Rahm has to be T5 with one player or lower. Solo third for Colin Morikawa, Rahm would have to place lower than T32 with one player. That might be a tall ask, given there's 38 players in the mix this week on the plantation course. Players to reach world number 1 prior to the age of 25. Remember Tiger in 97 with the Masters victory. Jordan Spieth, that amazing run in 2015, was just a tick over 22. And Rory McIlroy, capturing his second major in 2012, was able to get all the way to the top spot just before his 23rd birthday. So we are chasing history now with Colin Morikawa. I feel like with Morikawa's game, this isn't making enough of a splash as it should in golf media or among golf fans, because he's not Bryson DeChambeau.
No, there are no theatrics around Colin Morikawa. Everything is delivered on the course between the ropes with him. He's not making a lot of news outside of the ropes when it comes to his career. And it's interesting to see that here's a guy who's on the cusp of number 1 in the world, and there's still a decent amount of headroom left for him. His strokes gained around the green is pretty mediocre. His strokes gained putting, he's been well outside the top 100 at the end of every season so far in his young career. But it's interesting to see just how meteoric the rise has been up the rankings. You can compare it with John Rahm. But in Morikawa's case, he made his debut at the Canadian Open in 2019, and that broke him into the top 1,000 in the world. He was tied 14th that week. 6 weeks later, he was in the top 100 in the world. And it took him another 6 months to get into the top 50. But this is a guy who's on an endless upward trajectory. And, you know, you see the other guys that have done this. John Rahm is one of them, obviously. Tiger kind of set a gold standard for the ability to get to the top of the world rankings this fast. And Morikawa is extremely close to this pinnacle that he says he's dreamed of for a long time. And we saw that he would join Spieth, join Rory, and join Tiger. And that's all of those guys kind of started to hit a little rumble strips or speed bumps along the way after that, particularly Rory and Spieth. Tiger was the anomaly. He stayed there forever. And it's interesting to see how many peaks Colin Morikawa can reach before, you know, you start to get older, life gets a little more complicated, your career gets a little more complicated. But right now, everything's sunshine in Colin Morikawa's world.
Well, yeah, he hasn't really had to deal with chaos, although the Hero World Challenge, it was a big lead that he let fall by the wayside. But he doesn't have, like, the trauma of near misses that have accumulated in such a young career. It's like what Jordan Spieth experienced up through 2015, maybe even to 17. I mean, there weren't a lot of setbacks. It was just the chart was going that direction. And then you have that first inflection point. It's, oh, wow, okay, maybe I am fallible. Maybe there is a downside to my golf game that I just haven't experienced yet.
And I always remember, he seems like one of these guys who sets the next goal for himself very quickly. And I remember having a conversation many years ago with Ian Woosnam. And Woosie said he could remember when his career started to go downhill. it was the week after he won the Masters, because he had achieved number one in the world Monday of that Masters in 1991, won the Masters on Sunday, and he said he'd achieved every goal he set out for, and he just, instead of looking for another mountain to climb, he just slid down the side into a comfortable life after that. And Colin Morikawa is not the guy who's going to check off a box and suddenly not have another goal to replace it. He seems such a driven, motivated guy who's clearly got a checklist of things in his head that he's doing a pretty darn good job with two majors and on the cusp of world number one. He's checking them off pretty early.
All right, let's turn our attention now to Golf Channel analyst Paige McKenzie hopping on with us. We hear all this hype about Jon Rahm can become a dominant world number one. Why do you think Morikawa is a little more under the radar when it comes to that type of discussion?
The biggest reason I don't think he's as on the radar is he's not as an explosive as of a player as Jon Rahm is. We know that. Jon Rahm plays with a little bit more power than Colin Morikawa. And I think generally there's just a bias towards the entertainment factor of it. But I like the conversation that you guys are having as it relates to who Colin Morikawa is and how he got to this point. I've been recently listening to some old podcasts, and I came across one from Colin Morikawa when he first turned pro. And he talked about how he had seven events on PGA Tour under his belt before he turned pro, and he was considering at different points of his college career whether he was going to. And he actually sought out counsel of Jon Rahm. And he asked Jon, why did you stay in college for 4 years? And Jon said, I worked that last bit in preparation for the PGA Tour. And Colin took that same that advice and took that same philosophy so that he was prepared and he was ready when he got to the PGA Tour. He said those seven events on the PGA Tour prior to turning pro, he spent too much time on the range. He worked too hard. He was trying to do something different than what he normally does. And then what he realized is that what he does is enough. And by the time he got out there, he felt fully prepared. And I think that's the kind of intellect that you get with Colin Morikawa. That's the kind of philosophy and the process and the inquisition and figuring out what other people have done, but figuring out what works best for you. And that's why he's been so successful and made this seemingly seamless transition from collegiate golf into professional golf.
And when you put his golf game aside, because his ball striking and iron game is basically unmatched, but he's naturally curious and he's a good-natured guy to be around. So when he asked Jon Rahm for counsel, all right, Colin's spoken about this like at length. Justin Thomas was a guy when he first came out, grabbed dinner with him and started through osmosis kind of learning what's his routine. How does he approach the game? I mean, he's unafraid to ask those type of questions and then kind of figure out the best practices that he then wants to implement for himself. And we're seeing the success that he's had and the track record. He and Rahm are basically 1-2 for the fastest rise to not only stardom, but in the world rankings over the past 5 years.
And it's interesting how he gives you the occasional glimpse at what his actual goals and ambitions are. In that press conference yesterday, he talked about how he's unhappy with his consistency level. He complained that he's a little too inconsistent. This is a guy who made, I believe it was 24 starts around the world last year. He won three times and had 13 top 10s in those 24 finishes. So the idea that he's inconsistent will strike a lot of guys as kind of, they should be worried about it. If that's what his ambition and goal is, if that's too inconsistent a year for him, which is a career year for most guys who ever play the PGA Tour, then I think they ought to be scared if that's what Colin Morikawa is deeming as kind of an okay but inconsistent season.
Well, and statistically, when you look at the whole picture, it's just hard to kind of comprehend a guy who doesn't hit it that far off the tee, who's maybe outside the top 150 in putting, says he's inconsistent and he's world number two. Like, there are aspects in his game that he clearly feels I can pinpoint and still refine and take a next step, and that's scary to think that he's won two of the last, what, six majors, seven majors?
When you're number one in strokes gained approach and you're number one in proximity to the hole, you don't really have to putt that well.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Back on golf today, Eamon, I almost had to fact check this because I'm feeling old. This is Justin Thomas's seventh start at the Century Tournament of Champions. I mean, it seems like just yesterday it was at Alabama and then the Corn Ferry, but now seven times teeing it up at Kapalua, and one here in 17, and then one here again in 2020 as well.
Yeah, this is a real comfortable place for Justin Thomas, and I'm sure he's got high aspirations heading into this week to hit a reset button on his season.
Yeah, he beat Xander Schauffele, Patrick Reed on the third hole of that sudden death playoff. And what about 2019 and 2021? All he did was finish third both those years as well. So the outright odds, powered by PointsBet Sportsbook. Prior to the start of the week, Justin Thomas was the favorite. Then Victor Hovland goes 2 under his first three holes. Now Victor, 6-1. Justin Thomas plus 900. He is at 9-1, followed by world number one, John Rahm. Bryson DeChambeau, also pretty short odds there at 10-1 as well. So Justin Thomas on what to expect from the... Here's what we've seen out of Justin Thomas at the Century Tournament Champions. Mentioned a couple wins, a couple third-place finishes. His other two starts was just outside the top 20. Now it's time for Something or Nothing. So with that, we welcome in our something, Paige McKenzie, for more on Justin Thomas. Paige, Justin's record here in Maui means something or nothing this week.
It means everything. It's definitely something. Players that return to places that they've had good scores, good finishes, comfort on, absolutely. They earmark those. They look forward to them. They wait for them to be on the schedule. So absolutely, his record here is something. His expectations are likely higher here than they are other weeks because of the finishes that he's had.
I'm totally on Paige's wavelength on this one. Justin Thomas has played 24 rounds on the plantation course at Kapalua. Two-thirds of them are at least 4 under par. His average finish each year is, I think, 15 under, 14 under. That's going to put him in the mix at all of these events here at Kapalua. 22 under is your average winning score over the last 11 years. But his baseline, it seems to be only about 7 or 8 shots off the wind. So that's a pretty good place to start, confidence-wise.
Yeah, especially, I mean, what he's done the past few years, notching a couple wins. I'd love to try and be the contrarian and say, oh, well, with what we saw to Justin Thomas post-players, it could mean nothing, but my lean would have to be something. So I'll say that I teed you two up nice and gently with that first question, but it's going to be a little different with this next one. Will Bones being on the bag for JT full-time means something or nothing, not this week, but for the full season?
I'm going with something on this. And part of it has to do with the fact that I talked to Jim Bones McKay about Justin Thomas, I don't know, 18 months ago or a year ago after he had caddied for Justin. He was kind of pulled out of retirement. He'd been working for NBC, and Justin asked him to fill in because Jimmy Johnson had some health concerns. And just to hear how Bones talked about Justin, I have to assume it's a good and, if not great, relationship to begin with. But I know that Bones was feeding off of Justin's energy, which means I think it's probably circular, which means that I think Justin will be feeding off Bones' energy. So for that reason, strictly because I saw it from the Bones perspective or heard about it, I'm saying it's definitely something.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the caddy is part looper, part psychologist, and they don't come much better than Bones because he has seen some of the most spectacular wins and some of the most painful losses on the PGA Tour over the last 30 years, especially that 28 years he spent on Phil Mickelson's bag. So there's nothing he hasn't seen. And I think he's going to have a gift for keeping his player on an even keel and keeping some kind of perspective in there when things aren't quite going the way he would ideally like them to go. And he's also shown that this willingness to interject whenever the player is in the decision-making process and sometimes contradict the player. We famously saw him do that with Phil several times in high-profile situations. And I think that's an advantage for a guy like Justin Thomas, who is innately aggressive in how he attacks this game.
Selfishly, going to miss getting a chat with Bones in the TV compound because he's an amazing storyteller. But you know that it had to be a phenomenal situation for Bones to put the microphone down, step back inside the ropes. And this is a bag that I think after filling in for Justin Thomas, he had been targeting. And from Justin Thomas's perspective, to have a new voice, basically player-caddy relationships like a marriage. These can go stale as time goes on. It's rare to have Phil and Bones in the last 25 years. I mean, that's just, it doesn't really happen in professional golf. So I think for Justin at this stage of his career, he's a borderline Hall of Famer already. I think having a new voice, a new temperament, new working dynamic, seems like it'll be very healthy for him going forward. Not as healthy, though, with the shortest club in his bag. JT, statistically, struggling with the putter. Does it mean something or nothing right now to you, Paige?
To me, nothing so far this season. The strokes gained putting statistic for this season is based off of one event, so I'm not too concerned. Yes, he's had struggles in the past. It seems to be trending in the right direction, and he has had turnarounds before. Several years ago, he was outside the top 140 in putting. The following year, up to inside the top 50. So I think there is a... It doesn't, the past doesn't necessarily dictate the future as it relates to the flat stick.
I actually think this is something. The 208 in strokes gained putting right now doesn't mean so much to me. It's more worrisome that he's finished the last three seasons outside the top 100 in putting. And when you go back to his banner year of 2017 when he won the PGA Championship, he was tied 43rd in putting. So there's been a clear erosion in terms of his statistical performance in that category. And I think that's the thing that you see him working at most, George, week in, week out at PGA Tour events. He's grinding on the putting green all the time, and he's not yet quite seeing the results that he wants.
When there's smoke, there's fire. And that's the one club that's been withholding Justin Thomas from reaching the heights that we all knew he was capable of, especially in 2017. I mean, it was such an amazing season capped by that PGA Championship victory. We see flashes the weekend at the Players, 64, 68, remarkable. And then after that, we were projecting a huge summer for Justin Thomas. Instead, he was stuck in neutral because of the putter. So I do think it's something. It's been a prolonged hangover with the flat stick, and that's clearly what he needs to sort out if he wants to return to being a top three player in the world. Talking about a level of scrutiny. Bryson DeChambeau's name has to pop up, and Brooks Koepka, who's playing in the same group as Victor Hovland. Bryson goes off a little more than 40 minutes from now with Tony Finau, 4:55 Eastern time. Since the Ryder Cup and the World Long Drive Championship, we haven't seen him on the PGA Tour. He's taken a little breather. We're going to show you how he got here as we take a look back at his 2021 season, and boy, did that start off with a bang at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, this was an absolutely dominating performance at Wingfoot.
DeChambeau, his first major victory in convincing fashion at 6-under, the only player in the field under par, winning by six. And then the display that he put on at Bay Hill to win the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Some of the signature moments from all season on that par 5 six hole.
Yeah, particularly that long drive over the lake on six. That was just one of the iconic moments of last season.
And then he had his issues over the summer with his game, with his spat with Brooks Koepka. Sunday singles against Sergio Garcia goes driver on the first hole. The tee is up.
If you want a jolt of electricity for the American team starting the singles, that was it right there.
The flex where he gets the putter walking off the tee was phenomenal. And then he did the World Long Drive Championship, got to the top eight. I mean, it was amazing what Bryson was able to do. This the week after the Ryder Cup.
This guy is just pure box office, and this week proved it.
So what do you think are reasonable expectations for Bryson, considering he hasn't played competitively in a few months? And he said, swing-wise, he's not feeling totally confident.
He doesn't have a lot of recent competitive experience in that sense, but everyone knows what DeChambeau's work ethic is like. So it's not as though he's been kind of sitting on the couch eating Cheetos like the rest of us have for the last few weeks. You would expect him to come out.
You didn't have
prepared.
To like, make... direct eye contact with me as you made the Cheeto comment.
Nothing personal, George. I mean, but we know he doesn't have a great record here on this golf course. Seventh is his best finish, but he's also never shot over par. He's never failed to break par on this golf course. So there's a comfort level that he has here. And for a guy who likes to just wail at the driver, it's a pretty big ballpark for a guy like Bryson. So it's going to be a test more so at the business end of the hole for him this week in terms of working those contours around the greens and on the greens. And I think that's where it gets really interesting, because not having the green reading book, that is going to impact Bryson DeChambeau more than any other player on tour, because he's the one who's most reliant on the green reading book.
And we'll see how adept he is at coping with having to make those changes and how he can alleviate the pain points that are going to arise from not having that, something that he's been very reliant on in his career on the PGA Tour. This is what Bryson had to say as part of the On the Mark podcast. He said, there was a moment, that span of time, I felt invincible with my golf swing. Ever since then, it's been a struggle to find him. I don't know what matchups I did. I've looked, trust me, I've gone through everything. And sometimes the nervous system just can't reproduce the same thing it used to have. What comes to mind when Bryson says
this? This, to me, is evidence of how what professional golfers feel and what is actually true, or what they think and what is true, is not necessarily always the same thing. Because if Bryson felt invincible at the end of 17 into early 18, the results just don't actually back it up. He had one top 10 finish, a T7 at the Shriners, in the last 6 months of 2017, and it took him until the Arnold Palmer Invitational in March of 2018 to perform well as well. So the results weren't there. There was a gradual improvement almost across the board in his statistical performances. If you look at his strokes gained numbers back then, nothing huge, but it was a small incremental approach or increase in every one of them. That's probably, I think, what Bryson is reacting to when he says he felt invincible, but it certainly not wasn't evident in that time period in his results.
Paige, do pros go through those periods? I mean, like, how frequently does that happen where you feel invincible and then you just don't have that same type of feel?
Yeah, I think Eamon put it beautifully in that maybe visually it doesn't look any different, but physically it feels very different. And I did listen to this podcast, and Bryson was talking about an end of range of motion and how he was able to lock in positions where it felt so secure that it was unwavering in how he was delivering it. And that the putting was so bad, which is why, to Eamon's point, the results were not there. But that's not totally the issue. He was more worried about how he felt so good swinging the golf club during that time. And then eventually the putting caught up to where he was at. But I know players that when you go through this, when you feel like you're so in the slot or you're so correct on your positions that you can let go, that you can swing, that there's no search in your golf swing, it does. It's an incredibly euphoric feeling to step out there and know exactly what you're able to do with the golf ball because you're so confident in your swing. And he's admitting that he has reached that, but is still searching to get back there.
Searching in the dirt. I mean, that's, you hear so many pros go through the same ups and downs, especially from just a feel standpoint, even like you both have said, basically ad nauseum, the results may not dictate how that player's internalizing it.
I'm struck by Paige pointing out that, you know, that feeling of euphoria when you can step up there and let it swing. I know Paige has had that feeling. Have you ever had that feeling, George? Because I sure haven't.
Not on the course. Not with my golf game, that's for sure.
That's a different kind of swinging, George.
We'll save that for another day, David. As Golf Today rolls on, Phil Mickelson is making his grand return to the Century Tournament of Champions for the first time in 21 years, thanks to his win last year at the PGA Championship. What does Lefty's game have in store for us this week? Hang tight. More Golf Today on the other side of the short break.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life.
Phil Mickelson, throwing this out on Twitter. I'd like to thank all the crazies and real supporters, too, for helping me win the PIP. So Mickelson declaring himself the champ to get the second half of the money. I have to add an event I haven't played in a while. See you in Kapalua. I'll try and find another hot, controversial topic quite soon. So the last time Phil played at Kapalua, January 2001, got us thinking. Simpler times back then. What was it like 21 years ago? Phil, zero career majors, his first coming April 2004. Kala Morikawa, just out of diapers. He was 3. Wikipedia was launched that January. Number one song, you want to sing a few bars? Wasn't this a favorite of yours?
I don't think anyone wants to hear my voice on this one, George.
Destiny's Child, and then Gladiator, Best Picture. I mean, what a phenomenal, phenomenal movie that was back in 2001. So Mickelson now on the range, always putting in the work.
He is, and the work ethic has never dimmed with Phil. The results have dimmed a little bit. Obviously, he won the PGA Championship last year, which no one in their right mind could actually have predicted. He's made 9 starts since then. A T17 is the only top 30 finish he's had. He's missed 3 cuts. So Phil is relevant because of the theatre that he manages to curate around himself. You know, he's the
central... won the PGA Championship. That makes you pretty relevant.
It does, but that was 1 week in terms of a competitive performance from Phil. But he was relevant the other 51 weeks, too, because every time we see one of these matches created for TV, that is the Phil Mickelson show. He keeps himself very much relevant there. And he's also an extremely engaging social media presence. So he never quite drops out of the limelight, even if his actual golf clubs don't put him in that moment very often anymore.
It's crazy to think that, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, Phil wasn't even on social media. And now he's been kind of able to harness the power of interacting directly with fans and then figuring out how to leverage that following into figuring out from a business standpoint or even a match standpoint where he wants to kind of follow his path of progression beyond just what he does as a professional golfer.
And we're now all experts because of that in his coffee consumption and in his calf muscles as well.
But he also does share some behind the, like, peek under the hood type videos where he can give a swing tip here or thoughts or the fireside chat with Phil. He's a great content creator, and it's also amazing to think, okay, if you look at the PGA Championship versus his other results on the PGA Tour, it's an outlier, it's an aberration, whatever you want to call it. But he's like the guy who has his chisel and he's hitting the rock and 100 chips, nothing happens, and 101, boom, it all comes together and he has that magical week where he says, I was right. I knew it was there. You all doubted me, but I put in all this time, all this effort, all away from the game of golf where I'm working out, trying to lose weight, have this coffee regimen that I'm hyping up, and then we have Kiwa.
And to me, that's the real point of where Phil's career goes from this point onwards, is the need to be opportunistic. Because if you look at where he finished in his statistical performance last season, that season during which he won the PGA Championship, he was, in strokes gained off the tee, 152nd. In strokes gained approach, 131st. Strokes gained around the green, 153rd. And in strokes gained putting, 116th. That's the statistical profile of someone who loses their card, not someone who wins a major. But they don't have a strokes gained metric for guile and savvy. But Phil Mickelson would probably lead the pack in that category. And Kiowa was the kind of golf course that rewarded that kind of instinct. It's the same reason why I think Phil will contend in Open Championships for many years to come, because it's the kind of golf course and style of golf that rewards age and experience, and not necessarily just the raw power that we see so often today. And Phil still has plenty of power in the tank, but he has a lot more experience and guile than almost anyone else in this field.
If I'm texting you Monday and we're recapping Phil's week at Kapalua, what happened?
Wow, if I could answer that question, I'd be a bookmaker by now, George. You never know what's coming with Phil. That's what's made him such a compelling character for 30 years. I don't expect Phil to contend this week simply because the depth of the field that he's up against here is pretty deep and seasoned. And these are all winners who are here. And Phil's performance outside of Kiowa Island doesn't give you a lot of hope for kind of a consistent week-to-week performance on the PGA Tour. And he hasn't seen this course in more than 20 years. And a lot of these guys, you know, they see it year in, year out, and they're very comfortable here. Phil's not going to be as comfortable as they are.
Paige, it's hard to explain what was almost the unexplainable with Phil at the PGA Championship, kind of dialing it up to what we'd seen out of him in the prime of his career. As he gets ready to embark on 2022, do you think there's some more magic, or is that going to, as we look back on his career, be that one amazing week that was the high note to kind of wind down 45 PGA Tour wins and 6 majors?
To take a line from Eamon, nothing would surprise me. He could go on to win another major, or he could never win again. Neither would surprise me. But there is one secret, boys. There's one secret.
Ooh, I like
as it
secrets.
Relates to professional golf that every professional golfer pretty much lives and dies by. Not everyone, but I would say 99% of professionals would say that this is absolutely their mantra. It takes one good week to make a year. And that is exactly how I feel about what happened last year with Phil Mickelson. It's one good week, and I'm not going to evaluate the season by anything other than the fact that it's a W, and a W makes it a great year.
It certainly does, and a W would get him a return trip to Kapalua, see if he'd make the voyage over here in 23.
Well, he's played this tournament twice at Kapalua. He is yet to break 70 on this golf course, so he's going to need to up his game, given that 22 under is the average winning score over the last 11 years.
Which is wild. We were talking with Teddy Greenstein yesterday, and he said at the PGA, he was 200 to 1. This week, he's 80 to 1, even though he's never broken 70, but I get because the field size is one-fourth this week than what he experienced at the Ocean Course.
Yeah, but as Paige just said, you know, who would be surprised to see Phil Mickelson standing there with a trophy and a grin on his face and his thumb up on Sunday evening? At this point, nothing this guy does can surprise anyone anymore.
Inside 90 minutes until first round coverage right here on Golf Channel, the Century Tournament of Champions first round group that will be certainly getting its fair share of eyeballs. 4:55 Eastern Time, 20 minutes from now, Tony Finau and Bryson DeChambeau kick off their 2022 calendar year on the PGA Tour. Bryson, part of his prep at the Plantation course, going through his process to make sure his game is good to go for round number one. Looking back, it is 2021, the highs and lows and the wind down to his playing on the PGA Tour with the Ryder Cup and then the match against Brooks. Even though he lost that, do you think it was a win for him mentally to just get that out of the way and in his rearview mirror?
I do, and I think the match was certainly a way to draw a line under that. But I think the Ryder Cup was the bigger moment in his fall, because he strikes me as a guy who is this, like Djokovic in tennis, there's this need to be loved and yet tends to inflict a lot of needless theatrics on himself, which don't necessarily make him look particularly good. And I think the Ryder Cup was one of those moments where he actually could feel that kind of fondness from the gallery. And particularly when he drove the green, as we just saw on the first hole in the Sunday singles, that was the kind of Bryson DeChambeau we'd like to see more of this year. A guy who's making news because of what he's doing on the golf course rather than all of the kind of noise that seemed to surround him in 2021.
And I'd say there's been a bit of a disconnect with what fans want, and they're by and large pro Bryson because they want to see him try and drive par fours or take a direct line towards the green on a par five. He's one of the biggest follows week in and week out on the PGA Tour, and people by and large are cheering for Bryson. The missteps have been the spat with Brooks, and then also I'd say the media as well focusing on that versus what it's actually like on the grounds with people at the right, like the Ryder Cup is a perfect example. People want to see Bryson try and drive the par four first hole. I mean, there's almost nothing more thrilling in the game of golf than when that happens, and it's something that he can deliver.
Well, that's the disconnect here, isn't it? There's the fans love and cheer Bryson inside the ropes. Outside the ropes, it's not so much, because it's, you know, he refused to talk to the media for a good part of 2021. His caddy quit overnight after the Pro-Am in Detroit last summer when Bryson was the defending champion and he declined to speak to the media, and then made some ill-advised comments about vaccines not long after that and was so upset by the coverage that he chose not to talk to the media again until he had to at the Ryder Cup as part of his team obligations. And then there was that infamous, you know, my driver sucks episode where he criticised his own sponsor, Cobra Puma, at the Open Championship. So a lot of this stuff that's happening outside the ropes does not cast such a positive light on Bryson DeChambeau at all. And I think he struggles in those situations all the time. He never seems able to figure out how to manage those difficult, emotionally charged situations. And it would be great if we saw a little more evidence of some kind of growing maturity in situations like that, or simply have less situations like that this year.
Yeah, it's certainly some of those were self-inflicted. By and large, you wonder if the Ryder Cup and the match will be a catalyst for him, if those situations arise in the future, to be able to have a different way to handle them than what we've seen the past couple of years.
Sure, and when you look at the end, what we hope is the end of this kind of juvenile spat with Koepka, because that's a blood sport for Koepka. You know, Brooks is the Simone Biles of social media trolling. I mean, no one is better at it than him, and Bryson was kind of outmatched. It was glad to see the end of it with the match in Vegas. Wasn't necessarily great entertainment, but it drew a line under what was becoming a fairly tedious process.
Someone you won't see involved in that type of mudslinging on Twitter? Colin Morikawa. That would be a shock if he was in a head-to-head matchup. Morikawa, though, wouldn't be surprising any of us if he's on the first page of the leaderboard after round one at the Century Tournament of Champions. Welcome back to Golf Today. News surrounding world number one, John Rahm. Rahm committing to play in the American Express later this month. Remember, it's just 4 years ago, 2018, he won in a playoff over Andrew Landry with a birdie on the fourth hole of a sudden death showdown. Look at what John Rahm was able to put together in some of the most high-profile events we see in professional golf back in 2021. Top 10 at the Players, T5 at the Masters. Another top 10 of the PGA Championship, that win at the U.S. Open by birdieing the 71st and 72nd holes. Rahm, though, losing steam towards the end of the year on the European Tour, outside the top 10 in the Spanish Open, then that miscut at the Andalusia Masters. Rahm on handling the grind of his schedule.
When that Ryder Cup was over, I was drained for the previous year and a half. Not only the last 4 months, but the previous year and a half. And after I went to Spain and finished playing, I needed the break. Not only for me, but also for my family, right? We all endured it together. And I just wanted the time to be a dad and be a husband and just be there for my wife and my son. And I'm really glad I did it because, you know, since he was born, we had help at night and Kelly had help, but I wasn't that help. Because I was competing and I had to sleep to be able to compete. So as soon as I got back home, I told her, you know, I want to be more involved. Obviously, I want to help out. And for those 2 months, I really, really, really enjoyed having to wake up a couple times a night and take care of my son, be able to be there in the morning, give him a bath in the morning, feed him, give him a bath at night, just enjoy the simple things of parenthood. And knowing that basically once he starts going to school, I'm pretty much going to miss 50% of his life. I really wanted to cherish those moments. I know I'm not going to regret any time I decide to spend more time with my family. And that was what that decision was based on. And I couldn't be happier that I made that decision.
Wise beyond his years to have that vantage point at such a young age, especially as a new father. The scenarios for John Rahm to lose world number one to Colin Morikawa. A win for Morikawa, Rahm would have to finish lower than solo second. Morikawa finishes solo second, Rahm would have to play slower than T5 with one other player. And if Colin Morikawa is solo third, Rahm would have to tumble all the way down to T32 with one player. So from Rahm to Morikawa, we have Colin on the range now. He was the antithesis of John Rahm at the end of last year. He was seemingly playing everywhere. We saw a DP World Tour, Hero World Challenge. I was covering the Zozo Championship. He was playing in Tokyo. He had a global schedule that was only ratcheted up after the Ryder Cup.
And that's why he managed to win the race to Dubai on the European Tour as well, when he held off a faltering Rory McIlroy that Sunday in the Middle East. And John Rahm made his couple of starts overseas himself at the end of the year in Spain with not necessarily the performance he wanted. He missed the cut at the Andalusia Masters. But it's interesting, Colin Morikawa said yesterday in his press statement that going to number one in the world this week is in his own hands, which is only partly true, because other than a win, he's going to have to rely on what would be a comparative underperformance by John Rahm to get there. And I think that's not necessarily something you really want when you look at John Rahm's record. This is a guy who hasn't underperformed very much in the last year.
Well, how confident is Colin? Because I think the context and the lens he's looking through it is, if I win, John would have to finish in second. Otherwise, he's cooked. So that's why he thinks, okay, well, I can control it by going out and winning this event. Not like, okay, well, if I'm solo third and John has arguably the worst week he will all season, then I could ascend to number one.
Yeah, a guy who went through last year and won a WGC event, put himself in position to win a couple of others, and then finally had that dominating performance over the weekend at the Open Championship. That's not a guy who's looking in his rearview mirror. He's looking in one direction only, and in a lot of these events, he's not looking at anyone else in front of him.
Does he remind you of anyone in the last 30 years?
He does. He has definitely got this kind of meteoric rise. It does remind me a little bit of Tiger. The single-mindedness that Tiger had doesn't seem to be quite there, and that's, I think, in a way, a good thing with Morikawa. He seems to have there's a pleasing normalcy about him. He's a little like kind of McIlroy or Spieth in that respect, in that he doesn't seem as though golf is the one and only thing in his life. He seems pretty chill. You know, I guess that's from having attended college at Berkeley. Maybe he's still hanging on to some of the good vibes from there. But he doesn't seem like a guy who gets easily bent out of shape or easily distracted. He's got his goals, but those goals don't seem to define him.
He holds himself to a high standard. I think part of what's impressive with Colin, not just his mental makeup, but it's been the focus to his mental game as well as his fitness, working with Urban Golf Performance. And he's had a similar attention to detail with his body and his game to what Tiger did. I mean, famously, obviously, with his dad, Earl, who was like his mental coach. Basically, I think that's what gives Colin such a resolve inside the ropes.
And he's got a guy like Rick Sessinghouse as his teacher. And I think it's very interesting with a guy like Colin Morikawa. He has given no indication whatsoever that he's searching. And you see a lot of guys who come out in 2 to 3 years in, they're a little more comfortable and familiar with the golf courses. So they start to go looking for what is going to give them the edge, because it's no longer the fear of the unknown. They're kind of a little more comfortable. They're looking for that edge or looking for what's lacking. And he does not give you any sense whatsoever of a guy who is searching for anything.
Colin only searching for a win this week to try and wrestle away world number one from Jon Rahm. Rahm now also on the range. If there's anyone who could take an extended break and then compete at a high level, not only would you say the world number one, but because of his track record here at Kapalua, he's had his fair share of success with top 10 finish after top 10 finish.
Well, when you've never finished outside the top five in your career in strokes gained off the tee for any season, that's a pretty good recipe for any course. And with Rahm, it's an interesting one. In the last 10 years, only one winner of the Century Tournament of Champions has ever been more than two strokes back after round one. That was Xander Schauffele, was six strokes back 3 years ago when he won. Everyone else is within two. So you've got to get off to a quick start at Kapalua. And in round one scoring average on the PGA Tour last season, Jon Rahm was second. So he doesn't get off to a slow start very often.
Yeah, doing some deep dives there. I mean, the trends are your friends. So you would think with those analytics that Jon would be able to find his game quite quickly at the Century Tournament of Champions. What would have to happen for Morikawa and Rahm to become a rivalry?
Just keep doing what they're doing. I mean, they're playing their way into the final pairings and the top of a leaderboard on weekends. They're just not necessarily doing it that often in the same event. We have seen them go head-to-head together in the past, but I think that's kind of what this game needs. At this point, I feel as though we're more likely to see it on the LPGA Tour between Nelly Korda and Jun Young Ko, who've already kind of gotten it underway over the course of the last year. The men's game really hasn't had a major rivalry since, you could argue, Nick Faldo and Greg Norman 25 years ago. That we've had dominant stretches by different individuals. But the idea of seeing rivals go up against each other in the tournaments that really matter, the career-defining tournaments, and we haven't seen that, and it would be great to see some of it this weekend. I mean, we watched video yesterday of the Ernie Els Tiger Woods slugfest here back in 2000, and that held the promise that we were going to see these two heavyweights go at each other for a career, and it never quite happened because Tiger distanced himself from everyone else.
Yeah, and I'm a golf fan from my vintage. I mean, I started watching the PGA Tour mid-90s, basically, with the rise of Tiger Woods, and I remember his rivalry, quote-unquote, was like the big five that were trying to dethrone him. For those who aren't familiar with a historic rivalry like Jack or Arnie, it's not something that we've seen on the PGA Tour in the last 20 years. Why is it important for the game to have that?
Well, I think people tend to rally to either side of it. Just look what happened in men's tennis when you had Federer and Nadal, and then suddenly Djokovic is in there and there was a big three. And I always thought the big five was one of the kind of great artifacts of golf of a certain era, because it was one, it was a big one and four satellites around him who were just sort of basking in his aura, but they were not rivals.
No, he was a pure all by himself. Didn't really have peers. I mean, Tiger Woods and everyone else, and that's what Jon Rahm has been trying to separate himself, but he has Colin Morikawa nipping at his heels at world number two.